exploding the earth. Kind of a, we're in a kind of a section where we kind of will overlap a little bit from last week. Some of this material is probably pretty new, so go over it again won't hurt, right?
Right.
And I had hoped to take our lesson through, including the Tower of Babel, because it would be the last of the five major events that shape our world, our spiritual world, our physical world. But we're not going to get there. That's okay. We go as fast as we need to go. A couple of weeks ago, we introduced the hydroplane. I can't point with this thing, sorry. Hydroplane theory against the plate tectonics theory, which is the plate tectonics theory is what you read about in the newspapers, in the magazines. You will not read about the hydroplate theory, because the hydroplate theory has to do with creationism and the flood, whereas the plate tectonics version of it is a uniformitarianism idea, evolutionary idea of Earth. So we're not spending a lot of time on explaining the two, but we do have one slide today that will kind of talk about that a little bit. So we got our hands full just explaining the creationist side, and we're really scratching the surface, which is the way it always is, it seems like, in these studies. Found this quotable, Julian Huxley, probably not one you'd want to quote a lot, but has something interesting to say. In his Essays of a Humanist, Julian Huxley expressed his feelings on evolution and those of many of his contemporaries and successors by writing, "The sense of spiritual relief which comes from rejecting the idea of God as a superhuman being is enormous." You know, don't realize what kind of load these guys are under when they have to acknowledge a God, and when they cease to acknowledge God, they find it a relief. I think it's probably not much of a relief. I think probably he still worries at night about it. If you don't think about Huxley, we'll just skip him. He's an evolutionary biologist and so on and so forth. First director of UNESCO, so that tells you something about that organization. When the Bible does not say, I wish I could point, I can't. Is it any wonder that it will be difficult for the philosophical scientists who have thrown off God, as he did, or any concept of him, to be much help in determining the events surrounding the creation of the flood? Therefore, when you read any scientific literature, beware who the writer is. I'm talking to the choir here. If he acknowledges God in creation and as acting in history, we have the possibility of gaining understanding through the modeling of these events. So when I say the Bible does not say, we got certain things the Bible does say, and then you model what it doesn't say to make it fit what the Bible says with a plausible explanation. So if scientists say that the Earth's diameter is 7,926 feet plus or minus, I tend to believe him because it can be measured independently of each other. And I noticed that the dimensions are not always exactly alike. They're within a foot, so I guess that's close enough. If he says the Earth is eternal and its history is uniformly the same without any catastrophic events, I would likely doubt his evidence, even if he proposes some. Now, Walt Brown is who we're talking about. This is out of his book, In the Beginning. It's a monumental work. I was going to read something to you about him. It's off the blurb on his book. Because what he does, as you have noticed, is put together a complete picture of particularly the flood mechanics. So it's exhaustive. You know, you have people read little parts of it, but he's done it by his efforts trying to explain everything. And to that extent, you're probably going to make some mistakes. But he's no guy that crawled out from underneath a rock and saw the gecko sign. Remember him? Walt Brown received a PhD in mechanical engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he was a National Science Foundation Fellow. He has taught college courses in physics, mathematics, and computer science. Brown is a retired Air Force full colonel, West Point graduate, former Army Ranger, and paratrooper. Assignments during his 21 years of military service includes Director of Binet Laboratories, a major research, development, and engineering facility, tenured associate professor at the United States Air Force Academy, Chief of Science Technology Studies at the Air War College. For much of his life, Walt Brown was an evolutionist, but after years of study, he became convinced of the scientific validity of creation and a global flood. Since retiring from the military, Brown has been the director of the Center for Scientific Creation and has worked full-time in research, writing, and teaching on origins. He has a biography, by the way, Christian Men of Science, 11 Men Who Changed the World. So this is really a scientist, not just some person who wants to be one. So I am not a scientist. I don't even play one on TV. So a lot of the things that he says that I don't understand, I just take for what he says. If they're really way, way beyond understanding, I don't bring them to you because you can ask a question about it. So I'd say for those, get the book. And I would recommend getting the book. I don't know of anything, any other, well, Whitcomb's book earlier would have been an example of trying to explain the world from this, the world from a universal flood point of view. But I don't think he gets into the details that Brown does. In fact, if we have time in our 4 weeks lesson, I would love to do, or maybe we'll do it some other time, is compare what Brown says with Whitcomb to see once what the differences are. I'm sure there are differences, but there certainly will be some similarities. Okay, Walt Brown, in his book, In the Beginning, which I just read the blurb from, presents a plausible scenario for the flood events. His monumental undertaking is respectable, yet it will contain errors, and it is possible that others will build on it or correct it in time. At least we have a working proposition that we can that can be reviewed. He builds on the one assumption model. That is, he proposes that the subterranean water eruption is the major source of water for the flood. So he's organized the study into four phases. The rupture phase, we've studied that last week, maybe a little bit before, introduced the week before. And then the flood that came as a result of the rain and the foundations pouring water out, that's the second phase. And the third phase is the continental land bunching, which we're going to get into that this evening, as collapsing water vaults and the uplifts of the crust cause continental land shifts, slides, to form mountains and plateaus. And then we have, lastly, the recovery of the earth to function in a return state of equilibrium, which the world is still trying to do. That's why we have earthquakes. That's why we have volcanoes. All right, so we have, Brown comes up with a little different reason why we have earthquakes than the plate tectonics people do. It is clear that Adam's world before the fall was strikingly different than after it, and that the world of Adam to Noah was dramatically different than the days after the flood. We live in the days after the flood, and the world around us evidences that fact, the fact that some kind of catastrophe has befallen the earth, and that this should be a warning to all that another destruction is on the way. Hello? Did I miss one? Yeah. I just show you pictures that will remind you of things you probably have seen. We have the Grand Canyon, the gorged earth as a canyon shows a gigantic amount of water carved it out in a short time. A mile deep, 5 mile wide across the Colorado River could perhaps carve out a slit, but not this. We have sedimentary rock recognized by all geologists, but what sets these horizontal layers on edge? And no, I did not turn the picture, that is the way it is, in situ. We have bends in rock like putty. Uniformitarianism ideas are inadequate to explain this phenomenon. The dynamics of a waterlogged earth with fresh and pliable sediments pushed by cataclysmic landslides would account for these formations. Another folded plate phenomenon. And then we have the high mountain ranges. The highest ones are the Himalayas, the great elevations of mountain ranges in the Himalayas and Everest at 29,000 feet can be explained by continental sliding and upbuckling of the surface. However, the laboriously slow plate movement of today, supposed, which is 1 inch per year, needs 1 million years to move 15 miles. And the problem with that whole thing is there is no cause for it. There's no causative reason for plates on Earth to be moving unless it is trying to regain an equilibrium after some great Earth-changing event. Plates just don't move around for the fun of it, right? You ladies put your dishes in your cabinet and they stack there, right? And they stay there until somebody takes them down. But their theory is that somebody comes and moves those plates around. And if somebody did that in your cabinet, you say, "Who was in my cabinet?" They have no reason for these movements. And of course, have the Matterhorn, the majestic Matterhorn in Switzerland. Why does it stick its head in the air? Well, we have the Earth is a cracked egg, like a cracked egg. Wish I could point. I want to point so bad. I don't want to do this. So bear with me. I point, then I don't lose track. And then you know where I am. So it really cuts into my style. All right. Earth is cracked as an eggshell. The plates, and you can see the plates, the red lines, and this is the Eurasia continent. The plates are relatively stable, but are not in complete equilibrium following the catastrophe of the Great Flood. The water damage of the flood, the water, was an important component of the flood, but as the earth's crust was peeled back, the washed up and jettisoned debris became the mud that became the continental surfaces. Through these cracks, water at supersonic velocities escaped into the atmosphere to fall back to Earth as ice sheets and rain, as where Noah was, or launched meteorites and so forth. These ice dumps froze animals while standing, didn't even take time to lay down, and some of them, having been preserved in the higher latitudes, still remain. Lots of stuff that's really, really strange if you're just an evolutionist, or what we call Unitarianism. We have a passage out of Isaiah that often is taken as a tribulation passage, and I just cite one part of the verse. It says the earth is, and I think it's the tribulation, it's not a tribulation passage, it's a warning about what's going to happen in the tribulation and reflects back on what happened in the flood to warn them about the tribulation. Okay? Because it talks about the windows being open, that's where it starts. It says the earth is broken asunder, the earth is split through, the earth is shaken violently. All those things happen in Mr. Brown's scenario of the flood and the events surrounding it. And we have Hebrews, I think sometimes misunderstood as well. It says that Hebrews in 12:25 says, this is one of the warning passages, "See to it that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if those who did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will he escape who turned away from him who warns from heaven." And he goes on to say in verse 26, "And his voice shook the earth then, but now he has promised, saying, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens." This expression, "yet once more," denotes removing of those things which can be shaken as created things. So that's what we're talking about. Now, I think a lot of times this verse is taken as that when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, the earth shook. And that was the shaking. Well, I think it makes a lot more sense to make the shaking of the earth a flood because it was known by all. So we have, read this again, "See to it that you do not refuse him who is speaking, for if those who did not escape," and who were those that did not escape? Well, it was those that were in the days of Noah that refused to believe. Noah's generation in the flood, they refused to believe him, or refused him, and who is that him? Has to be Noah, speaking on behalf of God, of course. So Noah warned from earth about the coming judgment, but now God warns from heaven about the coming judgment. So I think we have, a passage that's not seen as a flood warning, or a warning reference to a flood, but I think it definitely is, because he shook the earth, and he will shake it again. Now it gives us a little bit of a clue what the tribulation might be like. A lot of times we take these kind of shaking and the language like that is sort of metaphorical, you know, we might say the earth shook when something happened, you know, but the earth really didn't shake. It just seemed like it shook because of the political implications. But I think when the Bible says the earth shook, I think it's going to shake. And I think when it said the earth did shake in the past, that's not a metaphor. It actually did shake. So if one of the things we have in our study, I think, I have come to a conclusion or come to appreciate that the flood was a much more of a cataclysmic event than Noah floating on the water with some animals in it and he landed safely and that was it. So a lot more happened during that time, which we still live in the consequences of that. So we have two sections this evening. I want to first talk about actually the end of last week's lesson about what happened in the outer space. I call the near outer space. We're not talking out into the stellar heavens. I'm talking about our solar system. And I want to point out that there is an asteroid belt. So here's the Earth, here's Mars, Jupiter, and of course the moon goes around the Earth. So we have this belt that everybody recognizes that's out there, and we'll read that there's around 30,000 asteroids in there. Okay? So how'd they get there? Well, first, let's talk a little about our calendar. Genesis 1:14 says that God said, "Let there be lights on the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, and for days and for years." So we did have seasons even in the pre-flood days. Were they cold? Were they hot? But we had seasons. They were remarkable, marked. They were noticeable. Verse 15, "And let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. 16, "And God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. And he also made the stars," which is, we remarked about that. He just also made the stars, just like offhanded, made the stars. And it's amazing. Well, we have here on the left here a calendar. I don't know whether we have zodiac stuff in here or not. I don't know. But we'll talk about zodiac because it comes into the issue of the earth wobbling. And that's where the zodiac signs come from. We won't do that tonight. So stay tuned. We'll try to get that done too. In case you don't know what the horoscopes mean, where they get their stuff from. But we have a calendar here that goes 12 months of the year. And it also has, that's the main thing I want to show you. All right. So in the pre-flood year was likely 360 days. Interesting that there's also 360 degrees in the circle, right? You know your math, geometry, whatever you want it. Now, supposedly, the Babylonian astronomers, according to Vilovsky, he's kind of an important guy in chronology, especially Egyptian chronology. He's the guy that kind of broke that open, that the traditional Egyptian chronology is wrong. Well, so he's the guy that studies this stuff. He says, the Babylonian astronomers thousands of years ago divided the circle into 360 degrees. Why? Well, perhaps it was driven by the 360 days a year. An easy choice in that counting days between years was then quite easy. Or maybe it was the way it was done. Maybe that was the way it was done before the flood. And that's how they counted years. And that's how Noah counted years, and they just kept on counting years like that, rather than they have discovered it. You know, we, like I said before, about the people that are don't have a Christian point of view or a point of view where God has intervened in human history, they tend to look to human sources for these reasons. It's really easy to go back to God and say, well, God set it up, and if there's 360 days to go around the sun, the earth goes around the sun in a year, that make it easy to count. So now it's quite off. It's not quite 360, 365. But back in the days then, I think that's probably what it was. So the present spin rate for the Earth is faster. So it takes goes 5.25 days more revolutions for the year. So that's 1.4% faster. So, and remember, go back to a flood, the calendar, it uses a 30-day month. Look what it says. Genesis 7:11, 7:24, 8:23-4 tells us that exactly 5 months elapsed during the first 150 days of the flood. So you take 150 days, divide by 30, you get 5 months, 30-day months. So that's how it was being used. This supports the idea that the pre-flood early Earth may have had a 30-day lunar month. Now, the Earth with a 360-day cycle, the Moon with a 30-day period or cycle. If so, then, Allah, the lights were then indeed set to be for the times and for the season without having to adjust it. Later on, like the Egyptians, they had to figure out that, oh, you ever notice that spring is getting later and later every year? They had to adjust the calendar. So they had realized the change. All right. So now we're going to talk about these comets or asteroids. Do you remember, any of you ever remember seeing Halley's Comet? 1986? Let's see. Come on. All right. Now, what did it look like? Did it look like that? Did it look like that? Why not? I mean, what did you see, I should say?
Not much.
Not much. I remember we still lived on Briars there, and our backyard was open. I went out there, probably got one of my binoculars out, looked at, where is this? Of course, we have ambient light in the city, so you know it's hard to see something that's kind of dim out in the sky. I did remember we did finally find it. It was kind of like a little cotton ball that was really dim, but no tail, or not perceivable tail.
Can it smile like these?
I don't think so. Well, I remember my dad talking about it, and my dad was born in 1912. Don't get funny here now. And last time it was around was 1910. So he'd tell me about it, not that he had seen it, but he always said, in 75 years, it's going to be back. And sure enough, it was back 75 years, 1986. So we went out to see this thing, and I was really disappointed. I didn't see much. And I thought to myself, I think this thing is getting dimmer. Because you talk about the olden times, how they saw this bright thing in the sky. Now it's kind of, you know, it's been 75 years. Next time it comes around in 75 years, none of you are going to be here. It's probably going to be dimmer yet. That tells you something. So we have these different, I remember the Boop comet, that was 1997. I don't remember the one in 2000. So we have these things that are out there in space that are floating around. People have jumped off the roof, you know, thinking the world is coming to an end because comet showed up. You know, they don't know what they are. They're fearful of them. Of course, don't have a godly point of view. They are scared. Asteroids, just kind of go through this really quick. They're really all the same thing. There's the density of them. We have the asteroids, a relatively small, inactive body composed of rock, carbon, metal. And these things are not, as we saw last week, they're not compacted together like a real tight thing. They can be very, very loose. They can have water in them. They can have ice in them. And there's some kind of bonding agent that holds them together. And they're sometimes not very big. Therefore, they get oblong looking. They get not conforming shapes. What? Irregular. Thank you. Thank you. My editor came to my rescue again. Irregular shapes. And if they get bigger and bigger and bigger, then they get enough gravity to start pulling themselves in and become a sphere. So you have these asteroids that are out there, and you have the comet, which is really, really loose material, relatively small, sometimes active object, which is composed of dirt and ices. And notice the waters that shows up in here. There's water that shows up. Comets are characteristic of dust gas tails when in proximity to the sun. Remember, the tail is always away from the sun. It doesn't follow a tail like in wind because it's the solar radiation that makes the tail blow away from the comet. So far from the sun, it's difficult to distinguish an asteroid from a comet. Meteoroid, we see these all the time, a small particle from the asteroid or a comet orbiting the sun. You don't see a meteor, you see the meteor. A meteor that is observed as it burns up in the Earth's atmosphere, we call them shooting stars. You don't see them in the city because ambient lights are great, but you lay out in the country on your back. I remember as a kid laying at home on the grass watching the stars, and I guess you're supposed to wish something, right? Something, wish up on a star. The meteorite that survives its passage through the Earth's atmosphere impacts the Earth as a meteorite because it gets here. All right, so we kind of generally talk about the same material, just how it's constituted in space and what happens to it. So we have all these comets. So I have a question for you. Is this just space junk waiting to fall to Earth? question about that. Is it falling to earth? Is that a dangerous thing? Well, could be, couldn't it, if it fell on your head? Is this part of the created good earth? You know, when you tell our little kids, God made everything. You go outside and see the shooting stars and so forth. Isn't that wonderful what God made? But wait a minute, is that really what we're saying here? Or maybe these shooting stars and these things we're having falling out of our sky, nothing of what God made that was good. It may be a result of what God, what man destroyed. So, did Adam have to worry about falling objects? Answer is no. So apparently they weren't up there then, were they? I mean, common sense tells you Adam would have to go out, and God said, now, Adam, when you go out at night, make sure a rock doesn't fall on your head. Now, they're called asteroids or meteorites, but they could do some great damage for you, so kind of watch out for them. None of that kind of discussion even expect to be had, because God said it was very, very good. There were no meteors that collided with another planet. There was no collisions on, no planets on collision courses. Everything was in harmony. So, well, maybe these comments and messages, well, we don't need to go there. Okay, if they were not part of the creation, then when did they form? What was the mechanism that caused them? Did parts of the solar system, planets break off? Some of the theory from uniformitarianism is we have a planet exploded. We don't know where it was. We don't know what caused it to explode, but we think it exploded, and therefore all these meteorites just came out of it. Now they're part of the asteroid belt. But that's guess. We got a better answer. So anyway, did it break off? If it broke off, how did it fly off of a planet anyway? Have you seen anything kind of leave the Earth today? You know, if gravity would quit, you would fly off the Earth, but, you know, nothing's leaving the Earth. And if it does leave the Earth, it'll be back soon. Runs out of gas. So nothing flies off the Earth. Nothing is caught in the cycle around the sun or the moon or in the astral belt. That just doesn't happen. So we have to have a reason for what these guys are doing up there, how they got there. Now, I said before, there are 30,000 asteroids have been counted and tracked. And this is from last week. Largest is Ceres. I don't know how you say that. It's a large one. Large is nearly 600 miles in diameter. It's like from here to Denver and a little more. It has about one-third of the volume of all the asteroids combined. That's a hunk. There are less than 20 feet in diameter. Some have fallen to Earth. It could do great damage, but Adam did not worry about it. And all of these guys pretty well got caught into this asteroid belt, with some clustered around Jupiter and some around Saturn. Or Jupiter. I think it's Saturn. I don't know what the other one is. I didn't look that up. All right. Well, I don't want to get ahead of the story here, but if something flies off the Earth, you got three choices. You want to give me one? Where's it going to go? Huh?
Back down.
Back down. But it's going to fly from the Earth, so it's probably not going to go back to Earth. So it's going to either fall to the sun, go that way. What's the other way? It's going to fly out of this whole solar system. Or the other thing is going to be caught in an orbit. And maybe that's close to your, excuse me, I don't want to point at you. You're getting close to what's happening here.
Or give the moon couples.
Huh?
Or give the moon couples.
Yeah. Just hold on your horses here, Gary. So we have this thing which everybody understands is there, and we know it couldn't have been there after the creation, and we know it's there now, so the best explanation is that it came there as a result of something, some catastrophe. That's where we're going. Well, we know that these do fall out of the sky. This is in Arizona. If you've been to the meteor, meteor crater by Flagstaff, this piece of iron, mostly iron, zinc and iron, the biggest piece they found. They didn't find it in the hole. They found it somewhere else because there was nothing found in the hole. When that hit, it either melted everything that was in the impact or it splattered it out across miles or around the edges. Last week, somebody asked me about iron because I said that the early post-flood use of iron came from meteorites. That's where they got the iron from. Then somebody reminded me, and I already thought about it, but I didn't have an answer at that time, but I thought about it later, and I do now, is that the Tubal Cain was a worker of iron in Genesis 4:22, so that was before the flood. The answer is, obviously, he was a worker of iron. The follow-through answer is that technology was apparently lost through the flood, and they had to rediscover it. And so they had iron. Now, we will find out later that a lot of the earth is made up of iron, a very, very common mineral on our earth. So, and we're getting ahead of our story, but if we're going to splash something into the earth, into the outer space, it will likely contain iron. All right. Let's see. Moving on. Just a matter of interest, iron is the sixth most abundant element in the universe. I don't know why we have to say universe. This is out of Wikipedia, probably in the earth. Formed as a single step, blah, blah, blah. Metallic iron is rarely found in the surface of the earth, laying on top of it, because it oxidizes. We call that rust. While it makes up 55% of Earth's crust, both Earth's inner and outer cores are believed to consist largely of iron-nickel alloy, constituting 35% of the mass of the Earth as a whole. So it's not on the surface, so it's probably deeper where this iron is. Iron is consequently the most abundant element on Earth, but only the fourth most abundant element in the Earth's crust. So you got to go deeper for the iron. And we saw last week that this eruption that goes down miles. So, you know, it could easily have drawn out the iron from the Earth and thrown it into the atmosphere. Now we get to the pimples, Larry. I was more discreet. I call it acne. We don't have any teenagers here, do we? Struggle with it. Have you ever wondered, when looking at the moon, why it has such a scarred face? It is as if the man in the moon had facial acne. In its own way, romantically, the craters have some beauty, but it also looks like a barren desert. Is that right? Spelled right. With huge craters that cover the entire face, what about the blotches that form the eyes of the face of the man in the moon? These imperfections diminish the reflecting light. God's purpose for it was reflecting light, right? Now we got dark spots in it. Did God make it to appear that it had been assaulted by an interplanetary missile bent on its destruction? Perhaps it has been in the wrong place at the wrong time when the Earth exploded. So these craters on the moon are disproportional, even more numerous on the backside, on the bombardment side than on the shaded side. So they're more here on this side than on the backside. Now remember, the moon doesn't spin now. It's stationary. So I see the same side no matter what, which is really kind of interesting. You'd think it'd move a little bit, but it's stuck. If you want to see the other side of the moon, you got to send up a space shuttle. Now, this is from last week or 2 weeks ago, just how this works. Remember, we have the rupture phase. The Earth cracks open, fountains of water, rain, and it rains muck and mud. And if this goes on for a 40-day period, we'll find out later that this muck will end up being almost half of it being mud and the other half being water. And all that stuff gets deposited on the surface of the Earth, comes up from below. And so, anyway, that's how it works. So we have these underground caverns that are held up by columns, as the Bible talks about, the foundation of the Earth. And for whatever reason, whatever triggered it, we don't know what it is exactly. We talked about the expanse of the Earth. With the tides, you know, every time the moon goes around, or every time the world goes around, the world flexes like this and finally came to a breaking point, which still has to be something added to it, because when God created the world, that would never have erupted, because God made it perfectly. So when all of a sudden something happens to the world and it damages it, then something has been ejected to it. I don't know what that is. I don't know if anybody knows what that is. But as Adam sinned, and it said, God said to him that the day you sin, you will die. And then we know that he lived another 930 years. We have the same thing going on with the earth. The earth was subject to the sin of the judgment at that point too. But some of these things didn't really show up till later. And it coincides with the time of the flood, when the earth, in a sense, exploded. So what was the trigger? Don't really know. I guess it could be God says, just do it. But you remember Mr. Brown starting with one assumption. The assumption is that there are under surface, 10 miles deep, caverns of these waters, 3/4 mile deep, under high pressure. And when that collapses, that water starts coming out and peels back to surface, and that becomes what's deposited as sediments. That wasn't what I was going to say. That was supposed to lead me to something. There we go again. That happened again. Well, we'll just pick it up wherever I left it off. So we have the idea here what's going on. Supposed to go the other way. We have the fountains of the deep, so to speak, and what the Bible calls them, and then the water raining down. Part of it, a lot of it becomes mud, and then it gets frozen and falls back to the earth, and that's where the mammoth and others freeze, standing up, as some of them did. Now, talk a little more about the moon here. And these things are hard for me really to grasp. I mean, I don't relate to this stuff. There's the earth and there's the moon in their relative size. Now we're going to put them in the relative distance and size to each other. Now remember, this thing's going to explode and it's going to affect the moon. You see, it's a long way apart. But remember, we're setting up that asteroid belt. And we see it now in its somewhat stabilized condition. We don't know what these steps were in between. So the hypothesis is that these rock fragments, some of them were fairly large by the size of the pimples on the moon, Larry, that they were fairly large to make that kind of impact, to make that kind of crater. Okay. So today, the same side moon always faces the Earth during the moon's monthly orbit. Surprisingly, the near side and the far sides of the moon are quite different. Almost all deep moon quakes are on the near side. That's where we're looking at it. And the surface of the far side is rougher, while the near side has most of the moon's volcanic features, lava flows. These are lava flows, by the way. Dome complexes and giant multi-ring basins. Lava flows, dark regions, have smoothed over many craters on the near side. Now, I don't know that you're up on physics, but if you have kinetic energy, which is energy that's in an object that's moving like a hammer, wham, the reason that nail goes in because kinetic energy is gathered in the hammerhead, and when it hits a nail, it's released at one time on the hammer's, on the nail's head. What would happen if you keep hammering on that nail, let's say it would take it, for an hour, and then you would touch it, what would it feel like? Hot, right. Okay, now you got the principle. So when something that has lots of mass with a lot of kinetic energy in it, and it hits something that's stationary flat, what's going to happen to it? Temperature. Immediately it's going to melt. Very, very hot. And it's so hot it melts the rocks. So that's what you have in the craters. And when the craters melt, they also melt the rock and it becomes lava. That's the dark spot. So you have all these are actual pits from rocks striking the moon's face. Now, the point is that they're not the same all the way around. So that gives you the idea that it came from one source, or not from every source. So we say, well, what's that one source? Well, we look to the Earth for that one source. Okay, so a little bit about how these things formed and why there are lava flows there. It isn't lava from inside the moon, because the moon is not hot on the inside. I'll get into this in a minute here. Maybe go on. Some have proposed that the moon's crust had been thinner on the near side, so lava could squirt out more easily on the near side than on the far side. However, no seismic gravity or heat flow measurements support that hypothesis, and the deeper lunar interior is cold and solid. Now, we have had seismic equipment sitting on the moon, so we don't have to guess at this stuff. You know, man has been to the moon. I forgot what they did there, but they did go there. So we do know something about the moon that we might not know from just watching it. So we have, this is a pretty much a dense object. The moon's density throughout it is almost as uniform as that of a billiard ball, different than the Earth, showing the little distinctive crust exists. Not only did large impacts from the giant base form giant bases, but much of the impact melted energy melted the rock and generated lava flows. This is what I expect you about the kinetic energy. This is why lava flows came after the craters formed. These meteors appear to have been formed recently. Of the moon's 31 giant basins, only 11 are on the far side, so that's a third of them are on the back side, the two-thirds on the front side. Why should the near side have so many more giant impact features? Almost all of the Maria flow, or lava flows, and almost all deep moon quakes would be on this side. The opposite side is true of Mars and Moon Mercury as well. We're not going to talk about that. I'm not prepared to do that. But apparently these kind of features are also on other planets that also maybe got bombarded by the same material. if the impacts that preceded these volcanic features occurred slowly from any and all directions, all sides would be equally hit. Only if impacts occurred rapidly from a specific direction would large impact features be concentrated on one side of the moon. Of course, large impacts would kick up millions of small rocks. This is also an important feature. That would themselves create impacts or go into orbit around the moon and later create impacts, other impacts, and even on Earth. Today, both sides of the moon are saturated with smaller craters. The big question, were the large lunar impactors launched from Earth? And our answer is, apparently. Yeah.
Hey, Don, did Mr. Brown give any indication whether he believed that the outpouring of material impact the moon that drove the moon into a farther or higher orbit?
What do we say about the speeding of the period for the moon? We went from 30 days to, did we give that already? 29 and a half days? Yeah, he does. It's a little bit quicker.
Between the period of time of the Earth's rotation earlier as compared to now, 5.2 extra days, would the moving of the moon at a farther distance decrease its gravitational pull on the Earth, and then?
Well, okay, the Earth sped up. The Earth sped up, and the Earth apparently got a little smaller.
Okay.
That would argue for that, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Like a skater, when it pulls in the arms, the speed goes faster. So the Earth pulled in its arms a little bit, not much, but it was enough to make 1 or 2% difference in the speed. Now, one thing I did not check out is that I understand the moon is drifting away from the Earth. I don't have that answer because he's not said that yet, but I understand that it is at a very slow rate. So, but in billions of years, it'll be out of sight, you know, so worry about it a little bit. Yeah.
So do you know which planets or moons don't rotate, you know? I mean, the moon's not rotating.
It's not spinning. Right.
Is there anything else?
There are, but I'm not able to answer that. I know their answer to that. Whitcomb has done that, and some spin this way and some spin that way. Is that what you mean? The other planets?
Yeah.
Were you going to help me, Larry?
You're going to see the Earth is a little bit smaller. Okay. And some of this stuff went out and struck the moon. So the moon is a little bit larger. So
I'm not going to give in to that, but let's say. I'm not going to concede, but go ahead.
Well, but if the Earth is smaller and lighter, it doesn't exert the same gravity pull on the moon that it did before. And if the moon is heavier and larger, then it's going to gradually force its way away from the Earth. That would be only a natural.
Okay, well, in other words, so it would drift away. I can't answer that. I will find out because that's a thing that I want to know about that. The moon didn't gain this weight when it was bombarded, because that stuff is still floating around the asteroid belt. It's still out there, so it didn't gain the weight.
It didn't stay there.
Huh?
The stuff that hit the moon didn't stay
there. Right. Well, I mean that means some didn't stay there. I mean some did stay there, but I mean it didn't all stick to it. Is what I'm saying. And what you see out there floating is asteroids. Remember, don't think of them as big piece of rock. Although there are some pieces of rock. But they're more like particles of dust gluing, clumbing together because of gravity. I don't have time for this. But this thing about gravity, we don't understand. Somebody asked about that. What is the force of gravity? What is that? One of the early space orbiting vehicles was sent out in space, they threw their garbage out the window, you know, so to speak. And you know what? It followed them all the way home. Because of the gravitational pull, they thought they're getting rid of it. But out in space, where there's no gravitation that competes with it, the spacecraft and this junk was close enough that they formed their own little attractive, you know, attraction. Instead of getting rid of it, they took it home. Yeah, it was the stuff you thought it was. Okay, so apparently, the moon as a whole has relatively few volatile elements such as nitrogen, hydrogen, and so on. Surprisingly, lunar soil contains these elements. I was going to say there are some elements left on Earth that did come from the moon that did come from the Earth. A large impactor came from the Earth recently. If large impactors came from Earth recently, most earthquakes should be on the near side, and they should still be occurring, and they still are. I like what this guy does. Throughout his book, he makes predictions, and he's made them over the past. And if they've already come true, he'll say, "And that I predicted this, and this is what's happening." He's got a slug of predictions that will happen if they do more research on science. I like the guy sticking his neck out, you know, which tells me he really wants to know the truth, and if he's wrong, he wants to be exposed. So I'm going to skip this because this has to do with, you know, we just had the super moon last week, you know. Well, that was the closest that it's going to be to the world, and then people worry about earthquakes being set off, and guess what we had in Japan? So, just an incident, I don't know. Okay, going back to our moon. The 30-day period is decreased by 2% loss of orbital energy. If you have a top, and moon isn't spinning like a top, but let's just say like a top, and you hit it with some energy, it'll go wobble, right? And loses some of its energy. Now, you know, out in space, it continues to wobble. In Earth, we have gravity and friction that starts winds it'll finally lay down. But when you have something interfere with something, that generally affects it. And we do think that it affected the orbit or the orbit around the Earth by a half a day a month. This decreased motion is explainable by the moon flying in the face of the rock. Now, 50% of the time, you think about the moon going around the Earth in this asteroid belt, kind of thing, half the time it's facing the music as the rocks are coming at it, and the other half of the time it's going along with it. So you have these high rate of impacts hitting the moon surface. That's what I'm showing here. Earth goes this way and the moon is coming this way, or vice versa, whichever way it is. So in this cycle of the 360 degrees, 180 degrees of it, he's running right into the face of this bombardment. So this would affect its loss of speed with this bombardment. So that's what we were trying to say before. All right. Do you want to stop right there? Ask questions? I don't like answering them. Okay, because the next one is the continental slide, and we're not hardly going to get this done in 10 minutes, but we're going to really try. Isn't that a wonderful piece of art? I stood back from that and says, "Ooh, that is ugly. Maybe we can do a little better with some prepared slides." I want to remind you that we're in the second phase, moving into the third phase, the continental drift phase. With the rupture, the flood stage, in this flood stage of continental shelves, we'll talk about this here being formed here. Most fossils and limestones formed. If I have time, we'll have limestone. There's an awful lot of limestone in this world, and it did not come from bones or seashells, even though there are seashells and some limestone. So we have sedimentary and fossil sorted and layered by liquefaction. That's kind of like something suspension, like we have quicksand is suspension. It happens when stuff gets stirred up, and within it you have these, we call them fossils, animals, and they sift out according to their sizes. So that's what happens during that time. We'll probably deal with that later. And we have during this continental shift time, we have the coal, oil, and salt domes being formed. These salt domes are in the ocean. And then we come to the recovery phase as we have the trenches, the submarine canyons, and the methane hydrates. Plateaus are formed, magnetic variations of the ocean floor, canyon forms. Ice age, earthquakes, volcanic activities, earth axis processes. This is very interesting. Talk about the world wobbles. Apparently it did, and it still does. And we have the flood basalt spill up on the Earth's surface. So that happens in the recovery phase. And we're still in this phase. We still have earthquakes. We still have volcanic activity. And we still have ice melt from the ice age. Yes, the oceans are rising. Yes, they are. And they probably will rise. Or we've come to some kind of equilibrium where they go rise, they'll come back down, go up and down. We don't know what normal is, really. I mean, what is today isn't normal. What is yesterday isn't normal. So we don't know what normal is, because we don't have history that goes back far enough. But we do know the ice is melting, and it may continue to melt, and we can't stop it. All right. Did that. This is a repeat of what I already told you, so just for time, I'm going to go by it. This is a subduction of plates, the plate tectonics theory, which is how the uniformitarianisms explain our Earth, and it's earthquakes and volcanoes, they say when the earth plates collide with one another, with another ocean plate or with a plate carrying continents, am I standing in somebody's way here? One plate will bend and slide under the other. The process is called subduction. At the subducting plate, as a subducting plate plunges deeper into the mantle, it gets hot. It's probably true. Melts as rain rock. It's probably true. Molten rock rises through the crust, erupts on the surface of the overriding plate. All right. The problem with that is this subduction. This is a pressure being pushed in this. What do you think would happen if this pressures are great enough to push that rock in there? What would happen to this part here? What would happen to it? Would it just kind of like, ever try to thread a needle with soft thread? What happens to the thread? Bunches up, lets you hit it exactly right. If it drags you, don't. So that's what's happening. This would just buckle up. You know, like pushing a yardstick. You keep pushing. Finally, it's going to flop up in the middle. Nothing to hold it down. So how they get this? For one thing, how they get this to even do this? And then the second question is, where is this pressure coming from that's actually going to apply this force? We have an answer for that. The Earth is still not in equilibrium. All these cracked eggshells are either a little bit too high or too low or too wide. They shift a little bit. They're trying to find their place again in this process. You know, a lot of water left the Earth. It's maybe a little bit smaller than it was. And so the Earth is still trying to find its equilibrium. We have an answer for that. They said, well, these plates are just shifting. Why? What's the force? And how can you force one plate under another one? And then that's how they suggest that the mountain ranges are raised. That is a mountainous pile of energy and no source for it. All right. Now, we have the flood. We have the very simplified diagram, the land masses sitting on a greased slide of water. We have water on top, makes these kind of floatish. They don't float completely because they're heavier than water, but they are lifted to some extent. So this flood phase, sediments and the sweep escaping water is increased until the volume of escaping water nearly equates the volume of water gushing out. So the sediments and the water are equal, nearly, he says. So we're not thinking just the water. Remember, this comes this muck and clay, and it gets pulverized by, we call it, what's the word we used? Say it.
Cavitation.
Thank you. Boy, I got help tonight. Cavitation bangs all these rocks into powder, which then carried out into rain and drop. So during this phase, a phenomenon called liquefaction sorts sediments, animals, and plants into horizontal layers that are more uniform and cover a larger area than sedimentary layers laid down today. Traces of these dead organisms are called fossils. Liquefaction process, often during earthquakes, the fine-grained water-saturated sediments may lose their former strength and, you know, they kind of loosen up and form a thick, mobile, mud-like material. Quicksand is one such expression of liquefaction. All right, so you get an idea. Somebody told me that you could drown in quicksand. This guy said you can't. I didn't know. Have you ever tried that? No, don't try this at home. But said you don't. You'll float in quicksand. You won't go in, and maybe you thrash yourself to the bottom with it. I don't know. But so we have these pressures that are building when this mantle is removed. Remember, these are removed because it's been peeled off. Water is gushed out here on this edge and taken off these edges. Remember, this is down, this becomes supersonic because some of these particles even get into the outer space. Mr. Brown even suggesting that there are some nuclear reactions that occur here. Now, that gives some propelling power. But he said, I'm not sure about that yet, and so he's asking for help to have someone check his formulas, which I'm not going to do. So at this point, the pressure to pop up occurs, this pop-up pressure occurs. The adjacent land masses slide off the slope and accelerates only to be stopped abruptly, causing a land jam, and mountain phases are lifted. It's a simplified explanation. Now, it's hard for me. They say this land mass, this bump went as high as 10 miles. But over 2,000 miles, that's not a lot, is it? But I'm reminded, you know, the coal trains that come through Nebraska, they say it takes more energy to pull that train that way, empty, than it does to pull it this way, loaded. Why? It's downhill. I've all wondered, if you let it go in the mountains, would it continually run? I mean, is there enough energy in that coal, kinetic energy now, because of the elevation, is enough energy in that coal to run that train? So I'm sure there isn't, because they run engines on it. But the idea that you put a train on a track that's slippery, it'll slide down. And so the continents apparently slide down. And you can see that. We have the Appalachian Mountains, which are small compared to the Rocky Mountains. And I have a map at the end. We see these Rocky Mountain ridges. You go down to Chile and South America, up the coastal, east-western coast of America, up into Alaska. You see that whole ridge goes clear along. So the ridge goes north and south, so the slide goes from east to west. Now, there's some other reasons for little other mountain ranges, but that's the main ones we want to look at or want to talk about. So this is the basic idea that we're talking about. These are hydro plates. Hydro's water plates are these. So they are shifting. And when this is raised up, and this is all underwater, this land slides. It either runs out of water down here for Greece, or runs into another landmass, or both, and it just crunches up. And when you have all this land masses, it just crunches up to what we have in the Rocky Mountains. We have, 14,000 feet peaks, foot peaks. Not the highest, but that's what they are there. And then there's talk about this mid-Atlantic range that has these rifts in it. And the Pacific Ocean actually does the opposite. Instead of it going up, it goes down. So as one side of the world is bulging, the other side of the world is, decreasing?
Contracting.
Good. There's an example how this would work. These rocks get pulled back. These bricks get pulled back. The pressure on the spring is maintained. And you get about so far that spring will pop up. Very easy, simple, physical explanation. Same thing here. This is how it started, this is where it opened up, and finally it bulged up, and setting these landslides into motion. I think I've said everything I need to say here, because of time. I think I've already told you this. So here we have then, coming out of our stabilized section, we have the continental slope, and this is the continental shelf. This is deep, and this is where it slid to and stopped and formed this deep cavern, which used to have dirt in it, which got washed out. All right, I'm going to quit here. I think I'm done. Oh, just something about limestone. We talked about supercritical water last week. That's when water gets so under such pressure that it can't boil. It won't boil anymore. In that condition, it can hold a lot more minerals than it could if it was not at that supercritical state. So apparently, it had a lot of these carbonite. Yeah, and that's what we call that limestone. And it was in these caverns. And when they have this supercritical water with this limestone, this calcium carbonate in it, it'll precipitate and settle out. And so when it swept up, all this limestone came out, as did other stuff. And so we have these, like these are the cliffs of Dover in England, and there are other places, the cliffs of Dover. And these are all limestone cliffs. And so where in the world do those limestone come from? And the answer that we have from the uniformitarianisms are that's animal life, the seashell life. Because you'll see some seashells in there, and so there's way, way too much limestone in the world for that. So we think it's created, and there are limestones have these seashells in it because they were part of the sedimentary rock. Did you know also that marble is limestone that's been cooked under pressure? So it'll react the same way to acids as limestone will. So it's a lot softer. You know, you have limestone or marble floors, you're a little careful because you can scratch it really easily. So it's not like granite. All right, so this explains where the limestone came from, which they can't. This is a secular chart, not in my book, but it shows these are plates that are, I think, would be considered, you call them continental shields. These would be those that would not have been buckled. They lay flat. And then see where the mountain ranges have been crumbled and pushed up. And you have the same here along this ridge here. And then we have this phenomenon of ring of fire. And it follows these mountain ranges as well. And of course, we know we have another thing to contend with in terms of the light world we live in. We've had the ice melt that had raised the ocean sea levels by 200-300 feet. And that covered those continental shelves that used to be occupied before the melting occurred. So if you have a starting point that the Bible is right, in other words, that there was a flood, and now you start looking for things that support what the Bible says, it's amazing what we're finding. And I said somewhere, maybe in my article for next Sunday, that scientists have been at this for 50 years now since they've had a chance to really start examining creationist point of views. And it's amazing what's been done in 50 years. Can you imagine if the Lord tarries, what will be done in another 100 years? And Mr. Brown's probably going to have some things dead on, and there's going to be some things that are really quite wrong. But in the meantime, we can be working on it, or they can be working on it, and we can be the benefactors of it. All the way along, all we're doing is trying to find out how God did things. And we have a God great enough that it's worthy of our inquiry. Because the more we know about what God has done, the more we know about Him, and the more we can appreciate Him and His greatness. I'm going to skip this too, because it's 8 o'clock. Okay. I'll risk it if there's a question.
I guess it's hard for me to understand how there could be enough water. Water's coming, the majority of it's coming from below, then it seems like there would have to be a void, in the earth to be able to get it to push up. So what filled the void in the earth?
It collapsed. So that's what we talked before about the earth got just a little bit smaller. We're talking about 4,000 feet of water. They say half the water that's on earth now, 7,000, 8,000 feet, if you smooth earth, half that came from the flood. So we have about 4,000 feet of layer here, 3/4 of a mile of thickness of water that was supported on columns, the Bible called the foundation of the earth, that these columns apparently collapsed. Now, that's why I said before, we don't know for sure why they collapsed. The one idea is that the tidal effect on the earth kept flexing it. And you do that twice a day, eventually something's going to break. And so when they started to collapse, the earth cracked open, and then the water started to get out, and then it just a cascading effect. One thing led to another. That's his theory. So we start with about 4,000 feet of water, most of which is now out. Not all of it. There's still water underneath the mountains. It's one of his predictions. We're going to find water under these mountain formations. So...
That
can't happen again. What did God say? It's not going to happen again. I said, I just ran out of water. No, it wasn't planned to do it again. All right. It's a good bedtime read, so. What I do appreciate about it, there's probably not a subject he's not dealt with or tried to, because you don't want to deal with this thing on a piecemeal basis. I just wanted to deal with the ice age. Well, that affects this, and that affects that. How the ice get there, you just everything affected. So you got to put it together in some kind of unified, organized, studyable package, and then pick it apart. And it's easy for me to pick apart some of these guys' work because I know nothing about science in terms of the way they do their mathematics and stuff. So I have to be a little careful that I don't prejudge, because if there's something really obviously wrong, somebody would have caught it by now. So we've got to look at something that really doesn't make any sense. So you might say, well, I don't believe in that presupposition that we start out with this under cavern of water. Well, the Bible starts there with it. The fountains of the deep broke up. I got to deal with that. That's there. Now, it's said in very simple form, and we might have liked to had, well, how much water was in those fountains might have helped us a little bit, but we don't need to know that. So what we're doing here is doing that extra study that we don't need to do, but because God did it, we're interested. At least I am. I'm interested in anything God has done. And I'm interested in what He's written. I'm also interested in what He's done in the world. And what He's done in this world is 5 catastrophic events, was the fall and the kicking out of the garden and the flood and the Tower of Babel, I'm missing one. They affect us, because without those things, you can't explain the world the way it is today. So that's why we have to have those 5 things now. We know where evil came from. We know how it's going to end. But we do know where it came from. We know where the world came from. We know how it was made. And we know how well it was made. We know that God didn't create the world in a pile of bones. I mean, He started with no death. So those kind of issues become important. And out of that, we come out of with the issue that we don't abort our children because it's considered death of a human being. We get that from the scriptures, you see. So we have a lot of things to learn. So I always don't want people to run away from science thinking that that's a scary thing. We're just going to be led astray there and it's going to take us down roads we don't want to go. So no, don't go down those roads. Go down the roads that the Bible lays out for us, and then have guys that do the work that have spent their year life's work in engineering to come up with some scenarios that would make sense. So, all right, we'll continue for 4 more weeks. And next week we're just going to kind of move down our chart. We go from the rupture stage, the flood stage, to the shift. We did the shift. I might cover some more of that planetary shift next week because we didn't do it in depth today. And then we go into the recovery stage, which is really where we're living. We're still in somewhat the recovery stage. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the evening, for the joy again, for knowing you. Lord, you not only have known us, but now we know you. And Lord, what you've done on earth is marvelous. First of all, in creation and in the destruction of the world, yet preserved Noah and his family so that you can provide redemption for humanity. And we're benefactors of every one of those acts. And Lord, we want to look into them to understand them, to know more about them, not to be questioning their wisdom or anything like that. But Lord, again, what you've done is of interest to us because you're the God we serve. Bless now as we go to our homes. Thank you for bringing us out. Keep us safe, keep us healthy, and keep us faithful to you. And we pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.